So we are continuing on this morning, week three of our Human Project sermon series, and we're thinking again this morning about what it means to be human. What does it look like, feel like for us to live the human life and to be part of the human experience? And then what is God up to? What is God doing in our lives, restoring and redeeming and working in us? And this morning, especially talking about the image of God, or in Latin, the Imago Dei, as we're going to hear about in a few moments as we read. So the image of God, what does it mean to have the image of God? What does it mean to be stamped by God's image on us? And part of what's happening for me is, as I think about this morning's message, but also think about this sermon series, there's a book that I've been reading recently called Christianity, The True Humanism, written by J.I. Packer, Thomas Howard. It's a book from a number of years ago. It has a very, for me, a very provocative title, Christianity, The True Humanism. Don't know how you all feel about that title. I can imagine other books, maybe they've been written, entitled Christianity, The True Feminism, or Christianity, The True Hedonism. In this book that Packer and Howard have written, they write this. It is often supposed that to fly into Christianity is to fly away from being human, which I want to say that because I think it's so true for many people. They think that when I become a Christian and I follow Jesus, I'm actually running away from what it means to be human. I'm kind of flying into some kind of spiritual realm, and I'm flying away from anything that has to do with real humanness. And then the authors say later on, we contend that, rightly understood, Christianity is the true humanism, since it has for its purpose the forming and freeing and exalting of our true humanness. The Christian story is ordinarily said to be about salvation from sin, which is true. But that means nothing different than from what we're saying, for it is sin that dehumanizes. Now that's a provocative statement. Sin dehumanizes us. And it is only in the matrix of holiness that authentic humanness takes shape. I love that. I love that quote. I love those words. For me, it gives me a vision, not just for this morning and the sermon series, but a vision for life. What is Jesus calling us into? He's calling us into the fully human life. So let's hear that call also this morning. I'm going to invite Marcos to come up and read Genesis chapter 1, 24 to 31.
Good morning. And God said, let the land produce living creatures according to their kind, and livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind. And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kind, the livestock according with their kind, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kind. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky and over every living creature that move on the ground. Then God said, I give you every seed bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food, and to all the beasts on the earth and all the birds in the sky and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food, and it was so. God saw all that he had made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was the morning, the sixth day. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. Anybody remember this? Yeah, this is a $2 bill, Canadian $2 bill, discontinued. How long ago now? How many? Yeah, about 20 years ago, 1996, they started discontinuing the $2 bill and was replaced by the coin we call today the toonie. And I was reading online that if you have a copy of this bill with a certain signature on it, there was some signatures that were typically there, but there are some bills that had a unique signature on it. Guess how much those uniquely signatured bills are worth today? $15,000. Yeah. I should have kept a few. I should have kept a few of these bills. Now, of course, whose image is on the bill? Looking a little younger than today. It's like 20, 23 years ago. Queen Elizabeth II. And her image is on the bill because, you know, we're Canada and we are still, I guess, part of the British Commonwealth. And she is, at least symbolically, the head of the British Commonwealth, and so her name is there. In some ways, giving the bill some authority, some importance, but also, you know, in some ways, Elizabeth is telling us, I'm still here, right? I still got some kind of connection to this great country of Canada. So, of course, the bill and the image is not her. But the image on the bill reminds us of her. At least it did when we had those bills. And this is not exactly what was going on in the ancient world, but I think the $2 bill helps us. This $2 bill helps me understand a little bit what's going on in Genesis chapter 1 this morning. Because this kind of thing was going on a regular basis in the ancient world. For example, this temple... Now it's located in southern Egypt. They actually had to move it because of a dam they were building. So they moved this whole temple to Ramses II, way in southern Egypt now. And all the four statues in the front are all of Ramses II. So, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 reminders of this great pharaoh from ancient Egypt. And as you entered the temple... Whoa, this guy is awesome, great, powerful. And as I leave the temple, I'm reminded of the same thing. And it's a little bit of a reminder, don't forget who rules this country. Don't forget, you know, as you go about your daily life leaving the temple, don't forget who's really in charge of Egypt. And a little bit maybe also this coin from the first century, Caesar Augustus. Now, I know his name is right there, but I got a feeling that some of us, even without the name there, would know, even though we've never met Caesar Augustus. Oh, that's probably one of the Caesars. His stamp on the coin, every time someone in the ancient world, first century, used the coin, looked at the coin, maybe even thought about the coins, boom, Caesar Augustus is your emperor. And wherever those coins go in the Roman Empire, remember who's in charge. Remember who's ruling this empire. And this is the kind of thing that was going on, as I've already said, in the ancient world. I get this quote from the Bible Projects and their little talk on the image of God. They say most everyone in those times, in the ancient times, lived under the rule of a king, and these kings proclaimed themselves to be God's image on earth, having the authority to carry out the will of the gods. These kings would also create idols, images, statues of wood, stone, or precious metal that were also said to be physical embodiments of gods on earth or images of God. Now, I find this really fascinating for me, because what's happening, what we just read from Genesis chapter 1, connects directly with what was happening in the ancient world. I'm assuming as the person writing down Genesis chapter 1 and people who were hearing it, those first hearers or the first readers would say the same thing is happening in the world that we know on this earth. So you're telling me the God who made the heavens and the earth, he is like a ruler, he is like a king, he is like the person in charge, and he has stamped his image on human beings. So very, very similar to what was going on. People had a sense, wherever they lived in the ancient world, this kind of thing was going on. But as we read Genesis chapter 1, there's also some very profound differences. And this happens actually quite a bit in the Bible. The Bible will use an image or a word or something that connects directly with the culture, and then has its own take on it, or sort of transforms that image or that thing that everyone thinks, oh yeah, yeah, we know that, but the Bible, oh, it's either a little different, or for me in this case, it's a lot different. So I want to pick up just two verses from our reading this morning that for me highlight the differences between the ancient idea of the image of God and the Bible's understanding of the image of God. So here is Genesis 1:26, just to hear it again. God said, let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so they may rule over the fish in the sea, birds in the sky, livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. And the big question for many people who read and study this chapter is, what does it mean to be made in the image of God? And the list is long. All the theories as to what the image of God is. You know, is it that people are creative, that they're rational, relational, emotional, that they have some sense of freedom, free will in terms of what they do? And I'm sure all of those responses have something true about them. But my response is, let's just keep reading the verse. Right, God makes them in his image, his likeness, and as I keep reading verse 26, there's a direct connection to ruling. Right? I'm going to make them in my image, in our likeness, so that they might rule. So connected directly with whatever we think is the image of God is this idea of human beings given the stamp or the authority to rule. To be some kind of ruler, some kind of royalty in the earth, in the creation. It's like God saying, I'm the king, I'm in charge, I'm the creator, but I put my stamp in you, I put my stamp, my image on you, so that you will rule like me. Right? We got to hear that really strongly, right? It's not like I created the universe, and now I put my stamp on you and just do whatever you want. Right? That would not be putting the stamp of God on us. God is saying, I'm the ruler, I'm in charge, I'm the creator, but I put my stamp on you that you might rule like me, in my image, in my likeness. Someone said, you know, God created the universe, and the intention was to share the ruling of the universe with another. To share the ruling of the universe with another, namely human beings. And one of the ideas in the ancient world, but also in Genesis chapter 1, is as people, as human beings, rule over the earth, as they're ruling, they're meant to be pointing to the ruler or to the creator. The way we rule or govern or steward the earth is meant to reflect or image or be like how God has done it, how God, in some sense, would do it if he was embodied in humanity. Now again, as people, I believe as people heard this, they say, oh yeah, we know what that's like. We know of this Pharaoh, this king, this ruler who does the same kind of thing. But in the Bible, there are some profound differences. First of all, in the ancient world, who was the image of God? Okay. That's true. We're jumping a little too quickly. I'm sorry. Yeah. So in the ancient world, for people who, let's say, heard Genesis 1 for the first time, when they heard image of God, they were thinking about one person. Right? There's one person in this country, in this region, who claims to be the image of God. And the Bible's saying, no. Whoa. It's not one. It's not some. It's not the elites. God has placed his image on everyone. All human beings, all of humanity. So this is not, as so often happens in the world and even in the church, the vision of Genesis 1 is not a two-tier view of humanity, right? It's not, well, some have the image and some do not. Some are great and some are not. Some are special and some are not. Or in our modern world, and this is just in some ways, if you watch a lot of media, this is constantly going on. And we have to remind each other, the message is not the message of God so often. There is the rich and the poor, the beautiful and the unbeautiful. The famous and all of us who wish we were famous, those, and this is also, it starts coming through, those who deserve to be here, right? They have money, they have wealth, they have status, they have strength, and those who maybe don't deserve to be on this earth. And sometimes even in the church, we get this two-tier view of each other. There are the real Christians and then the people who are trying hard to be Christian. There are the super Christians and then the kind of the regular Christians. There are the people who seem really close to God and really close to heaven, and then some of us who are, oh man, I wish that was me. There are the blessed and the not so blessed. And the image of God in Genesis 1 gives us a profoundly different view of the world, a different view of humanity. It first of all gives every human being worth and honor and authority and status. And then, for those of us who can hear that, it calls us to see in each human being worth and honor and authority and status. And if we don't have this in our minds, if we don't think of every human being made in the image of God, we are going to be tempted to treat people differently. We're going to be tempted to treat people inhumanely. That some have rights and some do not. Some get special attention and some do not. I was reading this article this past week. It was a very sobering article about 29 long-term care residents in Ontario who were killed by fellow residents over the last 5 or 6 years. So there are people who are living in seniors' homes, and they've found out that a number of them have been killed by fellow residents in those homes. That's awful. And then someone in the article said this: there's an attitude that some residents don't deserve proper care because they're already old. And that's a two-tier view of humanity. Some people have lived a full life, they're old, or getting slower, and they don't deserve the same kind of protections as other people do. And this morning, I want to suggest a great exercise for all of us would be start thinking about people. Like, have their image in your mind. And some of you could do this right now. You think about your friend, teacher at school, your spouse, your child, your neighbor. Do you see them? You think about a child growing in a womb. You think about seniors, those with disabilities. You think about someone you love to hate. You think about the person who's hurt you. You think about President Trump. I think everyone can see his image. I just got a feeling because we see his image so often. A great exercise for us is to say each person is made in the image of God. And a challenge for us, and I know it sounds a little bit weird, I think maybe here we could do it, is just maybe one person after the service or later on today, don't call them by their name. Hello, Pedro. Don't, you know, that would be my instinct. Just kind of for fun, but also to challenge your view of people to say, hello, image of God. Right? Your fundamental identity as a human being is not your name. Not your family name, is not what you do. It's that you've been made in the image of the one who's made it all. Now, this past Tuesday, I was listening to this awesome talk. And if you're able to listen or watch it, Rachel Den Hollander talking about justice and forgiveness. I knew it was going to be great, and it was great. And Rachel was doing something I wish the church would try and do more often. Take these two seemingly justice and forgiveness. How do we put this together? Instead of being just justice people or just forgiveness people, kind of always leaning one way or the other, how do we put them together? And I think she did a great job. And toward the end, she herself said, when I was thinking about this person who abused me and assaulted me, and many, many other people. On the justice side, I advocated for a life sentence for Dr. Nasser. That was from my point of view, that was justice for him and for those he abused. And then she said, but at the same time, I'm not on the side of those who say, when he gets to prison, I hope he gets his due. Right? She said, I'm not in favor of that. Treat him like the image of God, she said. Treat him like someone made in the image of God, justice, full justice. But also see him as someone made in God's image. And when she put that together like that, I thought, that is remarkable. If we could be people like that. I also want to read the next verse, Genesis 1:27. God created mankind in his image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. And the teaching here, I think, is pretty straightforward, but let me just spell it out. God creates both male and female. He creates both male and female in his image. He creates both male and female and gives them the task or the purpose of ruling the creation. So both of them, created, image of God, tasked to rule. And I pick up this quote from Ian Proven, who's at Regent College, in one of his books. He says, what marks out human beings from these other creatures in the earth, to whom they are so similar, however, is that each and every one of them, male and female, is made in the image of God. And then he says something quite provocative, but I'm going to put the quote on the screen here. If there are gods in the cosmos apart from God, they are women as well as men. The divine image that is to rule in the temple cosmos is male and female. Male and female. Male and female. It makes me think, and again, because we don't live in the ancient culture, we don't hear how explosive these comments, these words in the Bible are, but I'm thinking about the Ten Commandments this morning. Male and female in a patriarchal society, for God to tell his people, honor your father and your mother. Male and female. That is incredible for God to say. Now, part of me wants to end there this morning. I'm looking at the time. Part of me just wants to say, praise the Lord. We are created male and female. Let's just sing and go home. But this morning, I'm going to dig in a bit this morning. I'm going to talk for a little while about misogyny. A dislike of, a contempt for or ingrained prejudice against women. We could probably also put in there for some people a hatred of women. And I'm someone who's heard this word before, and if you'd ask me, I'd say, well, tell me what that means again and help me understand the word, and I'd probably say, that's not happened to me, and it's not happening in the church. And then I was on a retreat this past summer in close to Calgary, and I started hearing the stories of women raised in the church, good Christian women, good Christian churches, who started telling stories where I'm thinking, wow, this sin of misogyny is deep. It's awful. It's insidious. Which means it's very subtle, almost like stealth. It's so cruel. And it utterly goes against this fundamental teaching of the Bible story. And I'm someone who says, that's not me, and that's not us, and that would never happen at Nelson Avenue. But I'm realizing that when we respond that quickly, if I respond that quickly to anything, if I say, no, typically, people who respond like that just need a bit more time, kind of think and reflect. So when we hear about misogyny in our humanity's past or in our present culture or also in the church, I think we have to maybe wait, pause. Can we hear? Should we hear? Could we hear some stories? Can we think about maybe how this is maybe happening? And for me, it happens when we say in the church, if we only say this, God is male, or God equals male, or God equals maleness, if that's all we say, and we don't think of God creating male and female in his image, that kind of teaching can easily lead to misogyny. When we give the impression that women are not equal or are not as important as men. I heard a story this summer from someone who said, it was never said, but I knew that the boys in our family, our extended family, the boys, the grandsons, were more loved than me as the granddaughter. I just knew that. Nobody ever said it, of course, but I just knew that. When we don't honor women as we should, when we give in to the jokes and the stereotypes that are out there, oftentimes they're cruel jokes and stereotypes about girls and women. When we belittle women or allow others to belittle them or dehumanize them, when people, typically men, walk by a female reporter and say the crudest and the rudest things to her, all of these things either stem from misogyny or contribute to misogyny. And then I started wondering, and I know this is not easy to say this morning in a church community, but I'm wondering if part of our culture's confusion about sexuality, some part of it, I'm not saying all of it, I'm not saying it's the only reason. I'm not saying it's the biggest reason. But I'm wondering if part of our culture's confusion, it has to do at least some of it to the church's misogyny. That if the church gives the impression that women or females are less important, then maybe there are women and girls who want to become men. Why would I want to be a woman if you're telling me I'm less important? Or if the church gives the impression, you know, you can dehumanize, you can treat women poorly, I can imagine how some women would say, well, the heck with men. Right? The heck with maleness. And whenever we are confronted with something like this, for me, the best thing for the church to do is not to say, no, it can never happen. To recognize it, confess it, repent of it, be reminded of the amazing truth of this image of God on both male and female, and then to find ourselves in a different story. Right? Not the story of hating a gender or disliking a gender, but I would say the story of honoring a gender, which is the story, I think, of Genesis chapter 1, where God, in the midst of ancient cultures that said, just this king, just this Pharaoh is in the image of God, how God honors all of humanity by saying, you're all in my image. And how Jesus so often honored men and women. And how Jesus dies and rises not just to forgive the sin of hating another gender, but how he dies and rises to call us into a new way of thinking about gender. Calling us away from hatred, disliking, prejudice, belittling, dehumanizing, and calling us into a different path, a different life, to be truly human one to another. And as I think about this morning's service and moving into communion, I think this is the story of Jesus right here at this table. Because what I love to do when we celebrate communion is to recognize this meal is not just for a few. Jesus isn't calling just a few people or certain kinds of people. Jesus is always calling everyone, right? Men and women, boys and girls. And the only thing we have to do is to receive, right? To receive the good news, to receive his welcome, to receive his embrace, to receive his work for us, to receive this vision. I'm not just here for you and you and you, few, some, part of the human race. I've come for all. And I'm calling all, not just to the table, but I'm calling all into a new way of being human. So this morning, hear again the words of Jesus, as he said so many years ago, but I still believe he says it to us this morning. Jesus saying, this is my body. It's given for y'all. Right? It's given for women and men, boys and girls, young or old. And this is my blood. It's the blood of the new relationship, not just for a few of you, a new relationship or new relationship with God for all of you. All of you. And when I think about Jesus offering his body and his life for the sin of the world, I think that's a Jesus I want to come to. Because he's going to know what's happening in my life or in your life. Not making separation, just come and bring whatever's going on in your life. I'm able to listen, to hear it, and to, in my own way, by my Spirit, redeem and restore.